When President Bush told senators last week that he would seek congressional support before attacking Iraq, he was following in the footsteps of his father. It was January 1991. U.S. forces had been massing in Saudi Arabia following Iraq's invasion of Kuwait the previous summer. After first asserting that he didn't need to, President George H.W. Bush sought formal support on Capitol Hill. A resolution approving the use of force against Iraq carried the Democrat-controlled House with many votes to spare. But in the Senate, also controlled by Democrats, the margin of victory was just 52-47. Most Democrats were opposed. As Iowa Senator Tom Harkin explained to reporters, they thought the best way to deal with Saddam Hussein's Iraq was to maintain a tight regime of international sanctions.
We keep the sanctions on for another several months. Hussein can't get replacement parts. He can't use his ports. His troops are going to get pretty demoralized. If at that time we have to use force, it would be better to hit him when he's the weakest, not when he's the strongest.
Most Republicans supported the president, but some of them, like Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania, said that they too were supporting sanctions, not war.
If we unequivocally put Iraq and its president on notice of our intentions by a very solid vote, it is my judgment that we will have an excellent chance to avoid that war.
On January 12th, the Congress voted. 4 days later, airstrikes on Baghdad began. Pat Towle is senior writer for the Congressional Quarterly, and Pat Towle, it's often said that there were formal U.S. declarations of war only in the world wars, but didn't the January 1991 resolutions come awfully close to being declarations of war?
I think most members understood that's what they were voting on. In fact, before the votes in each chamber, you had members stand up saying, don't think you're voting for this just to get some diplomatic leverage on Saddam. If you're voting for this, you're voting for war. Everybody understood that.
How did it happen back then that even as there was a buildup in Saudi Arabia, obviously in anticipation of an attack on Iraq, the president maintained that at first at least that he didn't have to seek congressional approval?
Well, to some extent, this was just the continued playing out of the tension between the president and the Congress over the president's powers as commander-in-chief, something that dates in its modern form from the Vietnam War. In mid-October, by which time nearly 200,000 troops were over there, you have the Secretary of State, Jim Baker, telling the House Foreign Affairs Committee emphatically that he did not think it appropriate for the administration to promise that it would seek prior congressional approval. At the same time, you had Senator George Mitchell of Maine, the Democratic leader of the Senate, insisting that if we're going to go to war, the president has to come to Congress. So the issue was joined philosophically on the constitutional question fairly early on.
There's one school of thought that says that regardless of the merits, Congress will give a president warfighting authority, especially during an election year, if he asks for it. But was it a given? Was it a lock that he was going to win those votes?
I thought it was, though the Senate situation obviously was very interesting. We knew the vote was going to be close there, and what made it particularly interesting was that Georgia Senator Sam Nunn, the most influential Democrat on defense issues, Nunn, to the surprise of many, argued that we ought to wait for sanctions to take effect and see if they'd work.
When you think back on the debate of January 1991 and what was said in the House and Senate about going to war against Iraq the first time, are you struck at all by things that have changed a great deal since then over these 11 years, or are you more struck by how similar the arguments were?
The most obvious difference is that not only are U.S. military forces more capable of waging the type of war we'd be looking at, but that everybody now knows it. One of the striking things as the Gulf War unfolded in January and February of 91 was the extent to which members of Congress and the public were flabbergasted by the competence of U.S. military forces. They were thinking in terms of that bunch of stumble bums who'd gotten lost in the desert in 1980 in Desert One.
The failed rescue.
The failed rescue effort of the Iranian hostages. Because this increase in capability was evolving over 10 or 15 years. Tens of billions were being spent, and it all came home. So the big change, one big change, is that not only are U.S. forces clearly capable of doing what they would have to do, but that's generally conceded. Something I haven't yet seen in this debate that was a large feature of the debate in the fall and winter of 90 is a debate over burden sharing. Mm-hmm. We're going to go in and bail these people out. The Japanese need the oil as much as we do.
Why aren't the Germans doing it?
Why aren't the Germans doing
it? It's all part of the
debate. In fact, very, very shortly before the vote, then Representative Chuck Schumer, now Senator from New York, Schumer said he thought that the U.S. should demand that the other countries involved with interest in this should pay at least half the cost of the war. We haven't yet seen that burden-sharing argument surface this time around. That's an interesting difference.
On the first point, I guess it is striking that back in 1991, the argument was about the benefit of a war against Iraq versus the assumption that there would be at least hundreds, if not thousands, of U.S. casualties in a war of this sort. Today, the assumption is that there very well might be a successful action without thousands or even hundreds of U.S. casualties.
The role that the casualty estimates played in the debate was quite interesting. As people began to focus on what a war might entail, a tremendous amount of deference was given by those of us in the press to estimates from acknowledged experts in the field who estimated that very, very large casualty estimates and had what in retrospect were some astoundingly unrealistic estimates of the military competence of the Iraqi forces. That rolled almost unchecked until the first or second week in December, when the House Armed Services Committee held a week of hearings that focused pretty narrowly on the military nuts and bolts of how this might be done. The conclusion Aspin came to...
He was the Democratic chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, later President Clinton's Secretary of Defense.
That's right. The conclusion Aspin came to was that this could well be a relatively painless operation. He wrote a report after that hearing and said, we could be looking at 500 to 1,000 dead. That was the point at which I think the public debate began to reflect a belief that, you know, this might be doable at a lower cost, because these estimates of humongous casualties had pretty much become a sort of the wallpaper of the debate.
Are we prepared for those aims to see the body bags come back through Dover Air Force Base?
Through Dover, and is it worth it to keep $1.40 oil or gasoline and so forth? There's a lot of debate like that. You don't hear that now.
Pat Towell, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Pat Towell, senior writer for Congressional Quarterly.